This is the In Focus podcast from The Hindu.
Hello and welcome to the In Focus podcast. I'm Dee Sampath, your host for today's episode. More than a year after COVID-19 first made the headlines, some of the most basic questions about the origins of SARS-CoV-2 or the coronavirus remain unanswered. We still don't have clear answers on how the first human being got infected. We don't know if this virus naturally evolved the proteins needed to infect humans or if those mutations were engineered in a lab. At the same time, these questions, which ideally need scientific answers, have become heavily politicized. There are political attempts to blame the whole pandemic on China. And while this may be unfair, it doesn't automatically absolve China of all responsibility, including the responsibility to cooperate fully towards an impartial probe into the origins of the pandemic. Until early 2021, the hypothesis that the pandemic originated in a leak at the Wuhan Institute of Virology was dismissed as a crackpot theory. But suddenly, from this May onwards, a series of in-depth pieces, mostly from American publications, have given the lab leak hypothesis new respectability. How do we understand this sudden shift in narrative? What are the various interests and agendas trying to influence the origins narrative? And will we ever know for sure what exactly caused a pandemic that has dislocated modern life in so many profound ways? These are all interesting questions, and to answer them, we have with us Thomas Abraham. Thomas is an academic and former journalist who studies the role of the media in communicating risk and infectious diseases. He is adjunct associate professor at the University of Hong Kong and author of 21st Century Plague, The Story of SARS. Thomas, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Lovely to be here again.
Thomas, let's start with a very fundamental question. How important is it to know the actual origins of a viral pandemic? I mean, how does it help to know it?
Well, I think it is important from the point of view of science. It is important from the point of view of knowing how to prevent such events from occurring in the future, of trying to understand what some of the danger signs are, what are some of the danger signals that the world of nature sends out often in advance before something like this happens. Where should we be looking for these signals? So all of this, I mean, obviously, or it is an important part of the story of probably the biggest event that is going to hit any of us, for many, many decades and our lifetime, perhaps. Having said which, I want to take you up and go back to something that you said in your introduction about we don't know the origins of the virus. There's so many unanswered questions, and that's absolutely right. But we don't have the answers to those questions for any global new disease outbreak. If we go back to SARS in 2003, which we can think of as the ancestor or the great-great-great-great-grandfather of what we are experiencing today, we still don't know. We still haven't identified, or scientists have not identified, the progenitor virus or the virus that is close enough to have said, this is the virus, this is how it started, or the point from which it moved from animals to man, where it happened, or even where the first cases were. Similarly, we can go back 100 years to the 1918 pandemic. We don't know where that originated. And fair enough, you could say in those days, science was, 100 years, more than 100 years, further back. We didn't have the same techniques then that we have today. But take another big epidemic, and that was HIV/AIDS. We still don't know the exact point, or we have a rough idea of how it started, where the virus or similar viruses passed initially to man, and so on and so forth. But there's a whole area of uncertainty, And why is that? It is basically because these things take a lot of time. I mean, to find out something, it takes time, it takes effort, it takes money. And I think perhaps one reason is that once a huge event like this is over, people tend to move on. And, you know, thank goodness this is over, let's move on. And I think that is unfortunate.
Okay. So while one must acknowledge that it is not easy to pinpoint the origins of a pandemic like this, at the same time, of course, one cannot, as you said rightly, dismiss the need to do this in the first place. And having said that, there have been repeated occasions when people have tried to pinpoint the origin of this, and until last year, the general opinion, starting from the WHO, has been to say that it is a naturally evolved phenomenon. But suddenly, from early this year, there has been a shift in narrative in favor of the lab leak hypothesis. How do we account for this shift in narrative?
I think the general scientific consensus is definitely still in favor of natural origins. However, nobody has ruled out a lab leak. But how is it, and I think you really raised this issue, it's a really interesting question. How did it happen that in the last 2-3 months, at least in the narrative in the public sphere, if you will, the narrative among the chattering classes like us, has suddenly shifted to the fact that this was at best, it was either a leak from a lab or it was a deliberately engineered bioweapon. And as you have pointed out, I mean, this was something that was, that this theory had great currency during the Trump administration, and it has acquired new life. Partly is because it's an interesting story. We've had questions in a variety of different areas. One is, I mean, there have been letters, not scientific papers, but we have had letters and groups of scientists questioning the sort of, more than questioning, what they're saying is don't dismiss this hypothesis so easily. We've had a piece in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, which is not a scholarly journal, but still it's not a, you know, daily newspaper either, also making the same point. And we've had a couple of virologists as well, also making this point, saying, don't dismiss the lab leak, right? And so keep all your hypotheses up there. Don't diminish one. The reason is, why is this? Because I think in terms of human beings, I think we find this story a lot more interesting, right? It's got everything that you would expect. It also fits into our notions of what happens in China, right? You've got this authoritarian state, you've got the PLA, Tiananmen Square, see what they did there. China on its way to world dominance. And why? Obviously, they would do a bioweapon. Why wouldn't they do this? And even if it was an honest mistake, you think they would own up to it? No. So, you know, it fits into a lot of what we, our own preconceived notions of what is happening in China today. And so it's an easy story to write. It is an easy story for us to read and make sense of. And there are sources, I mean, the U.S. Intelligence Committee, community, for example, who have said that, well, this is a hypothesis. It definitely could have happened. And then the most interesting aspect of the story, which really gives it so much salience, I think, is the fact that a lot of this is done by non-mainstream scientists, intelligent amateurs, many of them, who have been going through documentation. They have downloaded things from websites, from labs. They have done homemade translation. They have picked up all sorts of interesting facts. And so you also have this Robin Hood narrative, you know, the citizen, ordinary people sort of fighting back against big media and big government and WHO, right? And really telling the story the way it is. So you've got all of these interesting these reasons, I think, why this is a really interesting narrative. And this is a narrative that is going to take, that has a lot of salience. The quality of the narrative, of course, is something else. And that is an entirely different question.
Okay, so you're saying that basically this is a very attractive story in the first place. And human beings being the kind of creatures they are, they will be tempted to gravitate towards a great story that also has the benefit of ticking all the right preconceptions we might have about the Robin Hood aspect of the story and what an authoritarian state like China would do and so on. So, but this then, are you then interrogating the kind of content that has been put out from this whole group that calls itself drastic or decentralized radical autonomous search team investigating COVID-19, DRASTIC, and they have come up with like huge amounts of very fact-seeming kind of content based on so many papers and documents that they have referred to. On the one hand, they seem very convincing to a layperson, but at the same time, many of them have come from US government anonymous sources. And people like, ordinary people are not in a position to go and validate them or verify them on their own. I mean, I can't go and compare two genetic sequences to see, which virus is up to what, where it came from, and so on. So how do we assess what has come out in the last 2-3 months in favor of the lab leak hypothesis?
Okay, so I don't think, none of what has come out so far really is in favor of the lab leak hypothesis. And it really goes back to this, all it said, and if we draw anything from it, it is that do not discount the lab leak hypothesis. Now let's look at some of these issues. I think one of the big sort of these big ticket findings, if you will, these sort of explosive findings. One, of course, refers to the Mojiang mine episode, right? And basically this states that, a group of miners felt ill, in this mine. It's an old disused copper mine in Yunnan province. And researchers went, they got the virus from this. And this is 2012, and they've cultured it, and they've worked on this, and then they have unleashed it onto the world. Now, I think we have Wuhan, WIV, first of all, they have been publishing from the last 6 years in scientific journals, and all of this is openly available on the sequences, on the viruses they've managed to get out of this mine shaft or this cave. And it's useful to know that all this work really started as part of the attempt to find some sort of virus which might have caused SARS in 2003. And I think in 2005, they identified a reasonable sort of one sort of distant ancestor of SARS. So they haven't found that yet. All of the viruses that they have found, including RATG-13, which is the sort of supposed to be the smoking gun, those sequences are up on global sort of databases, right? Then the debate becomes, did these miners die of COVID? Right? COVID-19, that's part of the thing. Did they die of something else? Now, the papers, and this is in Nature, Xi Zheng Li and the others at WIV have sort of said in a paper in Nature is that they could not find any common virus out of samples from these miners, right? They checked for Ebola, they checked for Nipah, and they checked for SARS itself. And this is in 2012. They couldn't isolate anything. Subsequently, after that, they went back to the cave from 2012 until about 2015-16, collecting samples. And it was then that they collected sort of, I think, 15 or 16, not all samples, but at least they managed to isolate pretty much the entire genome of 14, 15 different SARS-like, SARS-related coronaviruses. And some of these were really similar to the original SARS in terms of their spike proteins. Others had similarities in terms of their envelope protein, for example. And all of this suggested that the enormous colony of bats that were living in this cave, and I'm sure there are other caves as well, this was one cave that was actually sampled, was in fact a mixing bowl for coronaviruses, right? Because they were exchanging, bat A would be infected with one type, bat B would be infected with another, bat A and B would sort of, and bat C would be co-infected with two kinds of coronaviruses, both A and B, right? And maybe produce a third one in the fullness of time. So that is what, so in terms of this Mojang mine, sort of this smoking gun, to be honest, maybe I'm missing some huge thing that I'm missing. But just reading all the published data that there is so far, going back from 2015 and 16, I'm not quite sure the point that they are getting at. Oh, the other thing, of course, is that they have changed the name of this virus. And initially it was, I think, called 4409. And then suddenly they said 4409 is RATG13 and they renamed it. Once more, virologists have a pretty good reason. And the people who renamed it, the WIV team, have a reason. They say we're adopting a standard formulation. RA is for the type of bat, Rhinoculus, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, horseshoe bat. TG is Tongguan, the nearest town, and 13 is the year of sampling, right? And so from now on, we're just, instead of giving just numbers, we are adopting a slightly easier form of nomenclature, if you will. So once more, I don't see what that smoking gun is. Actually, if you could point me to some of the other, you know, sort of theory, then I could deal with them. This is the off the top of my head. This is the first thing that came to me.
See, one of the things that they keep coming up with is a number of lies which have been ostensibly, you know, seemingly put out by Xi Zhengli, right? So according to this, some of these articles which have come out in these American publications citing Drastic and also the writer, reporter himself, herself, is that she said that these miners did not die of corona kind of, COVID kind of symptoms, but they had a fungal infection. Mm. That later on proved to be a lie. Then they said, we were not working on SARS-CoV-2 kind of coronaviruses in WIV, but that also turned out to be a lie because they were working on it. And apparently nobody was working on gain of function research, and apparently, it turned out they were working on it. Yeah. So these are the kinds of frames of falsehoods which they have put out. I don't know if many of these, if they come across as falsehoods because the data, the fact that they were already available in the public domain is not known to the public.
Yeah.
But I don't know. What do you make of these lies?
So let's go back. Gain of function studies, they have been published, right? So they've published this thing even, and and they started, so let's understand what they mean. What is gain of function, first of all? It might be useful to actually quickly look at that. Now, this is a study that basically virologists all over the world do on different kinds of viruses. And the point really is, in a sense, to see under what conditions can this virus become more transmissible? Suppose you have a potentially dangerous virus. One example was H5N1 bird flu. Remember at about 10 years ago, that was the big, you know, people saw that as the big threat. Right. And the question really was, will this become more transmissible so that it, you know, transmits more readily amongst human beings? So there were labs in the Netherlands, for example, one big lab, which was working and trying to understand what conditions or how will this, you know, what are the changes that are required to, you know, to make this more transmissible. And if we know those changes, then we can look for those changes, right? Or we can sort of raise the alarm saying that, you know, you just need this tiny tweak here and suddenly you've got, you know, this much more transmissible virus. So labs, virologists, this is part of the thing, I think, that makes their life interesting, right? Not all viral, but their labs all over, they work on gain of function. So Xi Zhengli, what her lab was doing was trying to understand, can bat coronaviruses infect or human cell receptors. Now, coronaviruses, SARS coronaviruses, infected a receptor in our lungs, or not lungs, throughout our body called ACE2, right? And so what her team was trying to do is, can bat coronaviruses directly infect human ACE2, right? In the case of SARS itself, this came through animal intermediaries. But the question is, can you have a direct bat-to-human infection, right? And so they start doing studies on this. And what kind of studies do they do? One of the things they were doing, and all of this is publicly available knowledge, it's even in the WHO report. So they had, you could have, mice can be genetically engineered to produce a whole bunch of human-like receptors, right? So you had lab mice. That's the most recent thing they were doing. We'd have been genetically engineered to produce human ACE2 receptors, right, in their lungs and respiratory passages. So they were trying to infect these mice with bat coronaviruses, and not just bat, it's not entire bat coronaviruses, but really they would take the part of one coronavirus and stick, the body, if you will, of one coronavirus, and then stick on spike proteins from another virus. So, and usually these viruses they're not capable of independent survival, but this is just to see if the spikes will fit and infect a human ACE2 receptor. So this kind of stuff has been going on since 2016-2017.
No, Thomas, just one second. Mm-hmm. Let me stop you there. So from a layman's perspective, right, what you have just described is a kind of a research, yeah, what you have done is you've basically done genetic engineering to put humanized lung cells into a mouse. And then you have also modified an existing coronavirus by sticking some new spike proteins which it did not originally have.
Yeah.
So you're creating a new creature basically to see whether it can infect human beings.
Yeah.
Is that right?
That's
now, why would any sane person want to try something like this given the potential risks involved?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And this is a legitimate thing. Should gain-of-function research be banned? This erupted in 2004-2005 over H5N1, but this is a global practice. Now, I agree. Now, one thing, you know, the virus that is being engineered cannot replicate by itself, right? And normally these are meant to be non-replicating.
So if this kind of a virus were to leak from a lab, nothing would happen, is it?
It should not happen, right? And I think one of the interesting things from this is what you have pointed out too, and there needs to be a wider public discussion of gain-of-function research. What are the benefits and what are the risks? And so far, this has been within the scientific community. Some of the Wuhan Virological Institute work was actually funded by the U.S. National Institutes of Health, right? So, I mean, this is a global practice.
Wasn't gain of function research banned by Obama in 2014, and they found some kind of a backdoor way of continuing to do it?
Yeah, no, it wasn't backdoor. The NIH continued this because they felt that the research that was happening in Wuhan did not fall under this. So once more, it was not a backdoor way. This is the US NIH which continued this. So I think these, in fact, the questions you're asking are really interesting because, yes, there is a kernel of truth to it, but the way that it has been presented is not entirely accurate, right? And so in a sense, this is really what all the material that has come out questioning this has got some truth in it, but it doesn't have the entire truth. Which is why, in a sense, it looks interesting. But your bigger point is really, really relevant because I think you do need proper public discussion on gain-of-function research. What are the benefits? The benefits is if this is supposed to help you or virologists and sort of early warning systems in nature or scientific early warning systems to look for danger signs early, right? So if you see something like this in nature, which is similar to, you know, we know that this is capable of infecting human beings because we did these mouse studies, we should be really careful. So that is the plus point. The negative thing is everything that you point out, the danger, you know, of lab leaks, you're creating things which perhaps you shouldn't be. And we really need much, much more public discussion on this. What are the boundaries? What are the limits? And so on and so forth. So I think one good thing that I hope will come out of all these theories is some deeper discussion of gain-of-function research. But so far, none of what I have seen in media reports really has, you know, contributed to anything, deeper discussion of what is really a legitimate subject for discussion.
Okay, Thomas, you're still calling it a legitimate subject of research and so on. Let me ask you something. Is it, how do we differentiate between what is being told to us is a gain-of-function research from a bioweapons research?
That's true. I mean, it's really is a method, and gain-of-function research can lead to a bioweapon, right? That's one of the directions this can lead, in the same way that splitting the atom led to the atom bomb, right?
So that means any given state can say, I'm doing gain-of-function research while they're actually doing bioweapons.
Yeah,
research, right?
If somebody wants to do bioweapons, I mean, you would begin with gain-of-function studies. And then you need global, you already do have global legal conventions, there's the Chemical and Biological Weapons Treaty, which does have inspection functions as well, or provisions to inspect, which is supposedly banned a lot of this, but this still happens under different guises. I mean, H5N1 or even what is happening in Wuhan is seen as potentially, you know, this is basically to understand science. And so where does science end and gain of function begin? Or when does, this is another question that we need to answer. But, you know, in labs all over the world, it's important to understand that virologists are working on viruses to see can they, under what conditions will they become more dangerous, right? And part of this could, you know, some of this could leak off into bioterrorism in the same way that nuclear research can lead to all sorts of other things, both nuclear power on the one hand, plus as well as awful weapons on the other. So I think these are some of the issues that we really share. I mean, these are legitimate questions for debate. I didn't say that the research was legitimate, but this is a legitimate question for public discussion and public understanding and public debate. And one of the questions we should really ask is all the gain-of-function research that has happened so far, has it really prevented any outbreaks? We don't know. But right. I think these are things that we should be asking.
Right. One other question which has been brought up by this drastic group and related media reports is about biosafety of these various labs. And this WIV, Wuhan Institute of Virology, for instance, is supposed to be a BS4 level security, which is the highest, I suppose, for virology labs. Mm-hmm. And they have said that they have been operating under budget constraints, and what the kind of provisions that needed to be institutionalized in a BS4 kind of a lab was not really there. And therefore, the possibility of a leak cannot be ruled out. That's one of the things which has come out. Like, how would you understand?
Could well be. I mean, none of us have, really sort of inspected these labs. I have no idea. I wouldn't even know how to inspect a lab. What I do know is that started functioning in 2018, 2017. It's basically built with French collaboration. And it was the French who really built this and put all the systems in place and so on and so forth. So over the last 2 years, whether they've actually been maintaining it or whether, you know, it's completely gone to seed, I would think budget constraints is not an issue in China, and especially for big prestigious, I would discount that. So I wouldn't know how to actually answer that because I haven't really been there or talked to anybody there. And so maybe it's possible, Maybe it's not, but we don't know. We just have to take the words of those who say that it is not. Either we accept that or we don't accept that. But then the WHO group that went there, even though they did not do a lab audit, probably should have picked up on something had it been there.
Right. And one of the narrative threads in this entire lab leak hypothesis, which has been mainstreamed by recent media reports, is that one section of the U.S. government repeatedly tried to shut down investigations into the origins of COVID-19, ostensibly because they wanted to hide the fact that U.S. government funds had gone into funding this research, coronavirus research, that too in China. So is it, how common or unremarkable is it that the U.S. and Chinese were working together on research that could easily have been a stepping stone to bioweapons? Isn't it a bit like India and Pakistan working together on bioweapons research? Is it really expected?
Yeah, if they're working on bioweapons research, I think it is very unexpected. If they're working on studies on coronavirus infectivity, it is not unremarkable at all. Now, the list of grants that the National Institute of Health gives is why it's openly available on their website. So it shouldn't come, if anybody does some basic research, you will get a picture. Similarly, a lot of it comes from Eco Alliance, that a New York-based research, private, semi-private NGO-like research institute, which also has NIH money, which it funds to different people, including the Wuhan Institute. But all of this are on the public record. These are public institutions giving public money out. So both in terms of audits, congressional hearings, and plus what is on their website, all of this is already there. Now, I think one thing you need to do is really make a distinction between bioweapons, right, which is a virus that has been weaponized to cause mass destruction, and gain-of-function research. One leads to the other, but there's a big difference. It's the same way as saying that the progenitor virus of the SARS-CoV-2, this RATG, was 96% homologous, which is about 20, 30, 40 years in evolutionary distance, right? Similarly, between gain-of-function research and a bioweapon, that is a biological entity something biological that can be used as a weapon of war, right, which is effective, kills or incapacitates large numbers of people almost immediately, right? That is a huge, huge leap. And to be honest, one reason these things haven't happened is they're not very efficient. If you wanted to destroy and start war with an enemy, as a state, you would much rather, your conventional weapons are much better, right? Or even things like terrorism, fueling insurgency, all of these are much more effective than sitting and cooking up a virus and distributing it, right? And especially a virus that actually affected your own city first and made you look terrible globally and, killed people in your own country, right? Shut down your economy. You can say this is actually a bioweapon which leaked and so it wasn't meant to go that way. And we can keep hypothesizing, but I don't think it is not plausible because it's not an efficient way of doing anything. And if you did want to make a bioweapon, you would first start with the SARS coronavirus, which has got some ability to cause serious disease and so on and so forth, right? And then you'd work on that and try and make it more transmissible. But that was not what SARS-CoV-2 was. It was there's a big evolutionary distance between the SARS virus of last year and the SARS virus of 2002. And so it's not as though somebody started off with that. The logical thing would have been to start with that, right? And make that more efficient rather than trying to cook up something from scratch. That is not happening. So for all of these reasons, I would tend to discount the bioweapon hypothesis unless you have strong evidence to the contrary. Right, the lab leak hypothesis is more plausible because you do have leaks from labs. 2004, you had leaks of SARS coronavirus from labs, one in Beijing, one in Singapore, and one in Taiwan. And this is from the end 2003 to 2004. So it has happened before, though several decades ago. So that is more plausible, I think, than the bioweapons thing.
Right. Is it, I mean, you've sort of maintained from the beginning that that in terms of the various information and reports which have come out about the lab leak hypothesis, a lot of them contain a kernel of truth, but they are not the entire truth. So one of the things which has come out more recently is that the one of the main stories putting forward the lab leak hypothesis and blaming the Chinese was broken by the same journalist who broke the lies about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which led to the subsequent Gulf War. And also he had also put out another story, which was later on retracted, about masked men in Ukraine being Russian soldiers and so on. So isn't it very strange that this entire momentum for this lab leak hypothesis is coming from a journalist who has a track record of putting out U.S. government plans?
I don't know. I mean, we don't actually need to go into, you know, to evaluate the quality of a story. I mean, we can actually abstract from whoever does the story and just look at the quality of the evidence. And I think that probably is the best way to assess it, you know, rather than saying this person has done this before, but really look at the quality of the evidence. And in all of these cases, it's been made quite clear that this is, you know, U.S. intelligence sources have said this. And I think every serious news report that has come out, you know, whether it's in there was one in Vanity Fair, I think, fairly recently, the thrust of what they're all saying is that don't dismiss the lab leak hypothesis, and that you've got all these intelligence sources, then you've got Drastic, all of which is sort of pointing towards the lab leak hypothesis. So these are things that need to be investigated. And I would agree with that entirely. Part of it, a lot of it is coming from the US, maybe US government sources, and also US journalists are much more enterprising, right? And it'd be hard to see somebody from a mainstream media organization here actually digging into these things, you know, getting the paperwork and sort of, you know, spending 2-3 months looking at Chinese documents and doing that sort of deep investigative work that would be required, then talking to sources globally and trying to make sense of all of this. So there are very few, I mean, news organizations, there are very few news organizations globally that are interested or have the resources to do this. Many of them happen to be in the United States, and which is why this also gives space for this new form of information gathering and dissemination, and that is groups like Drastic, which are basically networks of people like-minded, thinking in a like-minded way, who gather information, throw it into the pot, right? Try and make sense of all of these things. So you have two ways of working now. And my problem with Drastic and so on is that there's no real sort of skepticism of somebody saying, assume this is not true. And one thing that any good news organization has, somebody who's doing an investigative work, is to have a team A and a team B. So team A produces the story, and the role of team B is to tear it apart, right? And it's from that sort of tension that you really get solid investigative journalism. Now, that does not happen in, you know, with sort of loose collectives like Drastic. It's really for the public to do this work. And good news organizations still work in this way, though I don't know to what extent some of the stories that are appearing have really gone through this process of skeptical editing. Which I think is really essential.
Right. The skeptical editing is, of course, an essential part of trying to make sense of this whole issue. So lastly, Thomas, just to wind up, given that this theory, as you pointed out, about lab leak origin of COVID-19 is going to remain in the realm of plausibility without ever being resolved one way or another, will we ever be able to tell clearly how the COVID-19 pandemic came about, and whether this is a natural virus or a genetically engineered virus? Will we ever get to know an answer to this?
I don't think we'll ever get to have a definitive answer to this. It's worth knowing, you know, even during 2002, 2003, the first theory that was that SARS itself was a bioweapon and that the PLA had produced this, right? And we cannot disprove that either. I mean, you can find distant ancestors, you can find closer ancestors, but the actual virus itself, was it created in the lab? It's like one of these yes and no things. It's almost like there's certain things I think which will always be unknowable unless you have a clear record. And if this is a bioweapon, or if there is a leak in a lab, or if there's a bioweapon, for example, I mean, you need to get the definitive sort of logs from that lab, and you need to get samples, and the entire process by which you started with virus A and ended up with SARS-CoV-2. I don't think we will ever get that if it exists. Similarly, if it's natural origins, I'm not sure we'll ever find the exact way by which perhaps bat viruses in Yunnan or maybe even Southeast Asia made their way first to Guangzhou, right, and caused SARS in 2003 and later to Wuhan. Because, you know, our understanding of nature and the viral world is so minuscule. What we know is literally the equivalent of one atom's worth of knowledge in an entire universe of, you know, of events going on. Because these are events that are random, they are, you know, and really we don't know the laws that govern many of these things. So science...
Thomas, I wanted your reaction to one aspect which I forgot to ask you earlier, which is the whole official investigation carried out by WHO on this question, and which concluded that a natural origin was, within quotes, likely to very likely, and a laboratory accident, extremely unlikely. And what I found very bizarre is that the very terms of reference which had been prepared for this investigation had already ruled out a lab leak possibility, number one. And number two, every member of this delegation which went to China was vetted by the Chinese government. So given these two factors, this WHO report, which is being cited by many to disprove the lab leak hypothesis, how credible is it?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. Now, point number one, the terms of reference ruled out lab leak, and that is not true at all. The terms of reference were to investigate the origins of this virus, right? And the terms of reference, there's a 3 or 4 page document on the terms of reference, and which repeatedly says to follow every lead until you get there.
Doesn't it say zoonotic origin specifically?
No, not at all. It is to look at the origin. There's a separate 3 or 4 page document on the terms of reference, and that these terms of reference were actually before even the teams were formed. Point two, the vetting. Yes, they were all vetted. So in one thing, I think, you know, we're doing a disservice really to those team members as well. So let's look at the lead. There were three groups that were found. One was the animal health, the animal market part of it. Number two was molecular epidemiology, which is how did this, you know, the virus actually evolve. And the third was the epidemiology. How did it spread, right? And these are distinguished people. One is a Dutch woman who is a professor at Erasmus University. The other is a Danish woman who is head of a leading laboratory in Denmark. And the third is Peter Daszek, who is head of this EcoHealth Alliance. And a lot has been made of his involvement in this because he was a funder and he's worked very closely with WIB. But then he was just head of one subgroup, and that was really looking at animal markets. He was not the leader of the team. And plus, there are a whole bunch of international scientists, right? And so you need to also then assume that all of these people were in on this conspiracy. And these are people who give interviews, they are outspoken, they're not under any gag rule. And if anything, they're paid by their respective countries. They owe nothing to China, right? So I think it's important to bear that in mind as well. And I think I've missed, one of your questions I think I was sidetracked on. So one was really on the terms of reference. The other was, I think, on the people there perhaps. And I think you had a third point, which unfortunately slips my mind.
I think it was basically these two points only, and the fact that both these points were brought out by this drastic group related media report. So mm-hmm. I've taken it from them. And the third one was, of course, they really couldn't go to that Mojang mine and, you know, do their investigation. True. They were prevented from going there and so on and so forth. True. So why would China want to do that?
Journalists were prevented from going. I don't think the group itself wanted to go to the mine and get into Bat Guano and Bat Dung. Journalists, there was a BBC team, and I think Western journalist teams were stopped from entering the mine. But had they gone there, I'm not quite sure what they would have found, except bats and Bat Guano. I mean, the point is, all of these drastic things, I mean, you can take little facts and you can present them in any way, depending on what you think is right. Right? And what you can think the reason of. And the point I want to finish with is all of these hypotheses are still on the table, right? None of them have been excluded. None of them have been proved. But the evidence that has been presented for the lab leak theory is really weak. And you know, you really need to come up with something better. Or the bioweapon theory or the conspiracy theory is pretty weak. And it's all available. And the WHO, the annex to the WHO report also has quite a detailed account of Xi Zhengli's response to these questions and questions to what kind of research were you doing and so on. Now, you can say she was lying outright. And to that, there really is no answer, except that she's a respected scientist who collaborates with scientists from all over the world, as does her lab. And she's part of a global network of knowledge. And if she could be completely dishonest, but then nobody who's been working for her, you know, on all these top names, virologists who've been working with her for decades, none of them somehow seems to have cottoned on to this fact, if it is in fact true. And so I would actually treat that with a pinch of salt, because this is not what her peers are saying. You know, those who should know her well, and her Western peers, since what Western scientists say seem to have a lot more weight. So her American peers, her European peers, her French peers, where she studied and trained and got her PhD, and who helped her to set up this, coronavirus BSL-4 lab 3 years ago. None of them are saying this. So I would like to, you know, you need to put that into the debate as well.
Right. Right. So the bottom line is that this entire shift in narrative doesn't really show us any new evidence that would tilt the scales in favor of the lab leak hypothesis. But it does do other things, which is number one, it suggests that we cannot outright dismiss a lab leak possibility. And number two, it sort of points towards the need to debate larger questions such as gain of function research and so on and so forth. Thomas, this has been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much
Thank
for
you.
Sharing your insights.
Thank you.
In Focus will be back soon with analysis of the biggest news issues. In the meantime, you can find our podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other platforms. Just search for In Focus by The Hindu. We'll see you soon.